take the mic.
I had a question for Professor Green. It's possible that I didn't understand you or that I don't understand the Rambam, but let me just lay out my thoughts and allow you to react to them. You talked about Rambam and doubt. Now, most of us in the 21st century, when we talk about doubt, we think about living a religious life where we're concerned about the tension between evolution and creation, or between a belief in an omnibenevolent and an omnipotent God on the one hand and all the evil that we see in the world. We live with various doubts, with various religious doubts. But when you talked about doubts, I think you were talking about a different kind of doubt. That Rambam was trying to cause us to have doubts or to renounce various primitive religious beliefs that we would have. And he was trying to debunk primitive religious beliefs that we have. But if I would, hypothetically, might be a modern religious person with religious doubts, is that something that the Rambam is pleased with? Is he suggesting to me that it's good to be living with religious doubts, or does he actually have, is he the kind of person who has real solutions, whether we like them or not, but answers to all of those things that people who think that they have religious doubts about?
Next question from the audience.
My question is, what is our human destiny? And of course, it's not just pure woo. It must be something more than that. Of course, the answer is, our human destiny is to grow morally, spiritually, intellectually. I disagree with you, Dr. Zuskin, that we have to stay in awe of God. Because if we stay in awe of God, we become mesmerized and paralyzed, and we cannot do anything then. But if we grow morally, spiritually, and intellectually, we can then help others around us. And the ultimate goal, I suggest to you, the ultimate goal is to achieve godliness. And if you're trying to achieve godliness, then there must be some values to God which negate what you said, that God has no values. God must have some values if you're trying to imitate him.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Larry Krauss. The question I'd like to ask is also just in terms of the guide. The way I understand negative theology, essentially it means that you can't really know anything about God. He's beyond our grasp. The second thing I understand about the... We can't know anything positive, okay? Can't know anything positive about God. The second point I understand from the guide is that he... talks about the revelation of Mount Sinai as a metaphorical experience, not something that necessarily actually happened, but something that was perhaps experienced on some sort of spiritual level, but not necessarily a physical level. And as a result of those two points, the way I continue to read the guide is that most of what he explains in terms of mitzvot and in terms of guidelines for living are based on policy-type proposals. That he's saying, look, if you want to create a society that's going to live a certain way, be moral, function well, he talks about necessary beliefs, that it's necessary to have these beliefs in order to have a functioning society. But I guess where I have some difficulty is if you premise the first two points, negative theology and the metaphorical notion of revelation, then really isn't the Rambam simply proposing a kind of legislation, or proposing that Torah is a kind of legislation that isn't necessarily based on anything totally substantive in terms of revelation from God, but it's really based on what is ideal in terms of creating society, as opposed to absolute truth. It is really a guideline for living. And what do you do with absolute truth in that idea, in that notion?
This is a question addressed to Dr. Lasker. I think this is the first time I've heard the notion that divine providence is childish. I'm very surprised to hear that. I just want to know, what is your source? Because it's such an integral part of Judaism, from what I have always understood.
Okay. One more. No, they're all in order.
I'm a urologic surgeon, and I'm used to go through skin, subcutaneous tissue, fat, and get down to the belly, so I won't be talking. I'll be asking more or less. First of all, you brought up the question that the Rambam is not accepted, the Shulchan Aruch is?
No, it's halakha lemaisa. We always look at the Shulchan Aruch.
Yes, but the Shulchan Aruch, if you look at the introduction, hold on a minute, it says that he goes by the three people. And there are many parts of the Shulchan, of the Rambam, which the Shulchan Aruch doesn't talk about. And you only go by the Rambam. So I think the Rambam was extremely successful. If you go to any yeshiva, they spend their time on Rambam. So to say that he wasn't successful halakhically, I don't think is true. And all the answers that I heard were not directly to it. Now specifically, you know, I would like, this is Dr. Siskin, I've asked it privately. According to you, if I understood correctly, when we pray Refayenu, or when we pray Slach Lanu, or when we pray Barech Aleinu, it's really a waste of time. In other words, there is no Hashgacha Pratit, where in some shape or form or at certain time will affect what I am asking for. But, and also I ask you, what about the miracles that mentioned in the Torah? Does the Rambam, according to you, believe that they did not exist, that there was no Kriyat Yamsuf, for example? And when it says, Vayida Yaakov Neder, he knew that it doesn't mean anything, he just said it. Or when it says somebody prayed, it does not really mean that he prayed and it was accepted the way it is written. Is that what the Rambam believes?
You know, I've always felt like when you get questions like this, this is where your conference really starts, actually. It should be like 9:30 in the morning, and this is where it starts from. I think you actually went below the bone already. You're like way down there. Anyway, I think it's very fitting that you all waited. It's very Maimonidean that you delayed gratification and you waited out, because I think this is the best part. So I'm going to go in order. The first question was to Dr. Green, about a clarification about your explication of the nature of religious doubt.
Well, I thank Professor Lochin for his question, because I didn't get a chance to explain it as clearly as I might have liked. It certainly, I did not intend to convey the impression that, you know, the essence of religion is doubt, or that the state of, you know, confusion is something that he was aiming for, that there were answers. Yes, he certainly had some answers. And, you know, the state of the modern 20th or 21st century doubter, I don't think is essentially different from the 12th century perplexed that he was addressing. So no question, people are in states of doubt. I mean, in a way, you're really talking about the science of doubt here. There are types of doubt which are good, and there are types of doubt which are bad. But why are they bad? Because they don't have to be in that state. The question to get to in the matter of doubt and perplexity is, on what issues can we have genuine knowledge, and should we come to accept that the tradition is, you know, sound and guides us in the right way? And by the way, one of the great certainties he had was the value of the Torah as a way of life. So that was not a matter for doubt. But there were some theological issues, and maybe even some legal issues, over which people do become doubtful, and which sometimes can be resolved by answers, and sometimes there aren't answers. Now, it's being able to distinguish between the two that makes for a person who has become a true student of Maimonides and has understood him properly versus someone who's been led into perplexity by Maimonides. I mean, where sometimes my students say, we study the guide of the perplexed, this is the guide that makes them more perplexed than they were before. But, you know, I don't want it to sound as if it's an end in itself, doubt. But it is a necessary part of human life, and even a necessary part of reaching a higher kind of spiritual or religious awareness. So, I mean, when somebody came up to me at the end and said, I forget who it was, that, you know, the question of free will. I mean, this involves questions of doubt. Do I do this? Do I do that? I mean, it's part of a higher human life. So if you can grade doubts, that's kind of what he's teaching us. Which doubts we have to have, and those ones we have to learn to live with and struggle with, and which doubts we don't have to have, and then he'll give us the answers to them.
The second question seemed to have been addressed generally, although at the end it seemed more addressed to Dr. Ziesenskar. I'm going to give you the mic. The question was, what is our human destiny? And the questioner seemed to have glossed something you said as that God does not have values, and therefore achieving godliness would be a non sequitur. So I'm wondering if you could address that.
Well, yeah, what is our destiny? He certainly believes in the coming of the Messiah, if that's what you mean, what is our destiny. He doesn't believe that it's going to be accompanied by miracles. He doesn't believe there's going to be a big cataclysm, and he doesn't believe there's going to be new Torah revealed, and he doesn't believe in anything like that for the Messiah. What he believes is that Israel will be at peace with the nations, and that we will be able to devote ourselves to study of the sacred texts and of the sciences. That's our destiny. That's the best thing we can look forward to. And if you say, did he actually believe that was going to happen? My answer is yes, not through miraculous means, but he did in fact believe it would happen. That God has no values, I don't think he would say that. It's not that God has no values. It's that don't think of God and value in terms of just a glorified picture of a human being. You've got to think of it in a broader and more selfless way. Now let's take just a very specific example. We could go on at length, but let's take a very specific example about how to answer this question. One of the things that we can know about God is that God is not material. That's negative. God is not material. But Maimonides thinks that we can know. Can we imitate God? Well, we do have a body, and our body has needs of sleep and food and water and so forth. We can, however, get ourselves to the point where our bodily needs, by which he also means wealth and things like that, our bodily needs aren't the most important part of our lives. We can get ourselves to the point where we, if you want to think of it this way, we spiritualize ourselves. We can get ourselves to the point where it's the eternal things that we're focused on, not the bodily or the temporal. And he thinks that that is one of the goals of Judaism, and that if we do this, we are in some broad sense in the imitation of God, that we are becoming more reflective. We have a broader view of things, less selfish. So yes, of course, there's value attached to this. It's just that once again, he doesn't want you to think of this as you being like or comparable to God. He doesn't want you to think of God as just a bigger, better, stronger version of us.
I would just say that the problem of the imitation of God is one of the central tensions in the guide between the life of contemplation, where the person is holy intellect, trying to act like God, being holy intellect, and the political life where God is judge and God acts out of necessity of the situation with his 13 attributes, and that therefore Maimonides says that's the goal of human life is to be the head of a just society and rule dispassionately. So I think that's one of the central problems in the guide, which of the two trends does one choose. A few years ago I decided there was another way of imitating God. On Sukkot, we read Kohelet. There's a line which says, "Ki ein chefetz b'kasilim," the God has no desire in fools. So I guess those of us who can't tolerate fools are engaging in imitation of God in this manner.
The third question seems to me kind of classically postmodern question, which is that the question is asking, in a way, is the Rambam just a pragmatic policy guy without there being an underlying metaphysic? In other words, if the foundations, what we know in classical philosophy as metaphysical foundations, are not really there, in other words, we don't know about God, so God is a kind of cipher, and Sinai may not be as we learned it, you know, in grade three. So if that's the case, and there's no underlying metaphysic, then what's all of this legislation anyway? Isn't it just pragmatism, necessary beliefs, and so on? And can we really have, is he just proposing legislation without any underlying metaphysic?
Larry, you raised an interesting question. And when you talk about, just let me address the Sinai thing, because that is very fascinating. And I dare say that it would come as a shock to most people to read the Rambam's description of what happened at Sinai. I don't think most people have a clue. In fact, I don't think most people have a clue if you just ask them what happened at Sinai. What do you think happened at Sinai? They wouldn't be able to tell you. So, but the Rambam has a chapter on it. But what he does there is he doesn't reduce everything to... he does have a metaphysic. And again, here he picks up every stage of the way. He has this primary, secondary principles of the law, and even embodied in, for instance, the Ten Commandments. So he picks up on, this is in short, one aspect of it. There he says, he picks up on the Midrash where it says that the first two, Lo Yelecha and Anochi, which I'm sure you've heard and you've gotten the point already by now, is the kernel, or maybe the two principles that Judaism stands for, the metaphysics of Judaism, that those two, that everybody heard it, Mipi Agvura. Right? So that's a midrash that everybody knows. But of course, the Rambam has a very different spin on that. Right? And that is, the first two, Lo Yelecha and Anochi, because they are metaphysical truths, because they are universal truths, everybody hears them. Because everybody has access to those two. Everybody. That's his interpretation of them. That is, these are universal truths that just like Abraham was a man that came sui generis out of nothing and arrived at them, everybody at Sinai, now how that happened, that's a different story. But everybody at Sinai has access to those two. They don't need Moshe. Maybe a little bit, but they don't need Moshe. The other ones, the other eight, right, the other eight are actually not. You're absolutely right. The other eight are part of what he calls generally accepted, general intelligible, that is, things that are... You have here actually the distinction, classic distinction, between Adam pre-chet and Adam after-chet. That is, had everybody at Sinai been in the state of Adam, just been involved with the world of Emet v'Sheker, of truth and falsehood, all they would have had to hear was Lo Yelecha Anochi. The rest you need, Moshe, because you actually need the greatest prophet, the guy whose mind is developed from all aspects, to actually formulate a law that is informed by the metaphysical truths. That is, this is the perfect law because it's informed by these two principles. But in fact, at Sinai, you do have a very, very clear mix of what he views, a very clear picture of what he views the entire Torah as. It's paradigmatic. It's paradigmatic of the entire Torah, the Aseret HaDibrot. That is, these are the two, this is the kernel, the first two, that is accessible. That is something everybody has to strive for. And all the mitzvot are there to preserve society, to take care of the welfare of the body, but as a path towards those first two. So you mentioned something very important, but I think it does mix the two. It combines the two.
The next question was addressed actually to Dr. Lasker. Do you see divine providence as childish, and if so, what is the source for that?
Okay. First of all, Maimonides believed in divine providence. He did not believe in the divine providence in the manner to which many Jews believe in it. He thought it was important that Jews believe in divine providence because he thought that it had political usefulness and was good for religion. In other words, that people should believe that if they do good, they'll be rewarded. If they do bad, they'll be punished because they're not going to do good and abstain from bad otherwise. Now, that type of providence is very much like the providence in a song for another religion, which is of a holiday of another religion, which is of a holiday that's about to come, about someone who's coming to town who knows when one is naughty and nice and therefore be good for goodness sake. Some of you may be familiar with such a song. That's not the Rambam's point of view. That's not that God is keeping tabs, exact tabs on everything. Let me give you an example. When we came to America to begin the sabbatical, I had ordered a car of a certain size, and when we drove it out, the rental car drove it out of the lot, the window didn't open, forcing us to turn around and go back and get a car which was actually much bigger and much more conducive to our needs. At which point I said that obviously God, I was extending personal providence to worry to make sure we got a car the right size, even though we're paying for a car of a lower size. At which point I said, if indeed God did intervene in this matter, I would really hope that he'd devote the same amount of time and energy to solving rather larger problems in the world, such as war and peace, and poverty and ignorance, rather than worrying about what kind of size car I would get. So what I'm saying is that this idea, from the Rambam's point of view, one promise, just as you take a child and promise them the Xbox or whatever else you said they wanted, the nuts, the figs, and then the clothes, or a degree, a university degree, so they get a higher salary, whatever you promise people to take to learn, this is on the level of childishness, and they will eventually grow out of it. And when you tell a child, the Rambam says, it's the introduction of the Perek Chelek and the commentary in the Mishnah, he says, if you tell a child who's playing with the ball, that eventually he'll grow up and he'll no longer think that that's the highest pleasure. He'll say, you're crazy. And if you tell a kid that eventually you grow up, you won't want toys, you won't want dolls, they'll think you're crazy. So just as you tell people today, you think the greatest joys are physical, eventually you'll grow out of it. Of course, you'll be dead at that time, but that's one way. That's how you grow out of it. This is what I'm saying is childish, to have the view that the personal intervention in the way the tradition teaches it is, again, I would say, is childish, which should be grown, for the Rambam's point of view, since most people are children, it's good that they have such a view, but people who become adults should learn to grow out of it. And I think this returns us to the question of success. When I start my course in medieval Jewish philosophy, I ask people whether, according to the Bible, God has a body. So I get different points of view. Most people say, according to the Bible, God doesn't have a body, despite the references to hands and foot and whatever else. And almost inevitably, someone says, "Aval katuv ein lo demuta guf eino guf." It's written he has no image of a body and he has no body. And I said, "Well, where is that written?" And they said, "Well, katuv esham. It's someplace. They know it's an important pasuk, right? It's an important verse." So I tell them that this comes from the Yigdal prayer, the Yigdal hymn, which is based on Maimonides' 13 attributes. So Maimonides was so successful in inculcating the lack of the divine corporeality, that God doesn't have a body, that people are taught as if it's a biblical verse, that it's already inherent to the Bible itself, which it obviously isn't. But the Rambam, when he discussed teaching incorporeality in Guide, Part 1, Chapter 35, what he said is that should be emphasized. Everyone, women, children, etc., should learn that God does not have a body. But the more nuanced parts of theology, the attributes, what one can say about God, and presumably that would include questions of providence, one should not teach this publicly. This is things which people should not be exposed to unless they're able to inculcate it. And in the same area in the guide, he talks about the fact that the secrets of the Torah are like meat and bread. That if you take a baby and you feed the baby meat and bread, the baby will die. Not because meat and bread are not good food, but because the baby's not ready for it. That's why I use the word childish. I see that I've not at all satisfied you. And
Let's move into the next question. We're gonna segue that into the last question. Actually, I just wanted to interject that I'm very impressed by the discourse that takes place when you're renting cars. That's quite a high. The last question comes from Dr. Judah, and it's one that I am in great sympathy with, and actually one that I tried to state off the outset, and it really segues from the provenance issue, and I think there are two parts to it. Number one, I'm interested in what you just said, Dr. Lasker. If, let me put this as bluntly as possible, have Frum people gotten it wrong? In other words, because that's really where all this leads to. I think that at a certain point it has to, all these questions have to segue down into our religious lives. And I'll make this personal, because I believe education should be personal. I've had quite a bit of illness in my family the last few years, and I often find myself in the position of saying Rifa'enu. And I also have been studying Maimonides for a quarter century, and I'm aware of all of those teachings about providence, and it's a very disconcerting feeling to have a kind of split screen in your head where you're sort of feeling on the one hand maybe he's listening, on the other hand maybe he's not listening. And I find these parts of myself in conflict. So partly I'm wondering, when normative Orthodox Jews, through their religious training, honestly and sincerely believe that when they ask for something, or that God will answer, or if they do something, God is aware of it, is this just a kind of primitive mistake? And would Maimonides actually, not necessarily discourage it because of pragmatic reasons, but intellectually believe this is wrong? And therefore, leading to Dr. Judah's question, which is, what happens when we pray to God? Is it, quote-unquote, a waste of time? And I think the way he meant it, just before we go on, is not, is it a waste of time? And the answer is, no, it's never a waste of time because you can self-elevate. I think he meant it in the most basic of ways. Is it a waste of time because God isn't really going to respond and react in the way that we think of and hope for? And I guess the last question, does the realm believe in miracles, is really just an offset of all of these. So you may start.
Thank you. Providence. He says at one point that providence extends, but not equally over everyone. If you asked, what do you have to do to participate in God's providence, he refers you sort of back to the book of Job again. So I think what he's saying here is, the higher up you go on this ladder, the less that you judge your life on the basis of personal factors like health, wealth, and so the higher up you go, the more you have spiritualized yourself, the more you are seeing things globally, the more you are looking at the eternal values rather than the physical or the temporal ones, the more you participate in God's providence. Okay? But that means that if you get to that level and you stub your toe, or, you know, you wake up in the morning, as I sometimes, you stub your toe, the toaster doesn't work, the power goes out, the whole, you know, that kind of stuff has nothing to do with God's providence, according to him. Now, let's talk about prayer. No, he does not think prayer is a waste of time. I don't think prayer is a waste of time either. The question is, and this is a deep question, what do you think, what do all of you think, what do we think you are doing when you pray? Okay? What are we trying to do? I put it to you that God is not a genie in a bottle. This is not the sort of thing, you know, where you rub the bottle or you rub the lantern and the genie comes out and has to grant your first three wishes. If that's the way that you think of prayer, then I think, according to Maimonides, you are just flat wrong. Okay? Now, do I sometimes think of prayer that way? Yes, I do. I admit, I do. So don't assume that what I'm saying is that I'm somehow at a higher level, because I'm not. Okay? So in talking about human psychology, what he says is one very important point. He says we all have to feel that we can call upon God in times of need, and that if you had a religion that told people that you can't do that or you shouldn't do that, it would be a religion that would collapse immediately. There's very few people. The people who would follow that religion could probably assemble in a phone booth. Okay? So, just as... Yeah, right. Just as in ancient times, If you had said to people in ancient times, I've got a new religion for you, it's called monotheism. But there's only one problem with this religion. It does not involve animal sacrifice. Our ancestors would have said, you're crazy. Every religion has to involve animal sacrifice. It was a basic human need. So, by the same token, I think what he's saying is that for us, of course we need to feel that we can call upon God. Of course we need to feel that God is listening. Of course we need to feel that we can somehow influence God or pressure God or beg and plead with God. Yes, we all have that feeling. But we have to make the effort to get beyond it. We have to make the effort to say, wait a minute, there's a way of looking at these prayers and accepting them at a higher, more spiritual, more enlightened manner than just to think that if I ask God for healing, that my chances of not visiting the doctor have just gone up. Yeah, I mean, there is a level at which I think he would say that it's just wrong to look at this as direct influence on God.
You know, Ken, you get off easy. You get to go back. Say your piece, go back to Chicago. I got to live with Dr. Judah after I talk here. So, anyways, I would say, I would pick up on that and say the following. That is, actually, not only is it wrong or an error, the way, if you have, I'm going to say this because I think that's what the Rambam says. I mean, you can believe what you want to believe, but I think this is what the Rambam says. If you believe that prayer does the things that traditionally we believe prayer does, then you are actually practicing in the shul idolatry. Actually, what he says is that you are actually practicing something worse than idolatry. Because it says idolatry, at least, all they do is make up imaginary gods. But if you have this view of prayer, where God changes, God responds, God intervenes, right, and that when you say Akeel Agadol Agibor Banira, that you think that those things are actually describing something, then you're actually doing something worse because you're taking the God that you believe in and you're corrupting it. So he actually thinks that it's worse. So I mean that's what I believe he says. But on the other hand, why is it so bad to think that, I mean, even in the traditional world, in traditional circles, we don't think that tefillah just works, right? You have to be a good person, you have to have midas, you have to have mitzvahs, you have to do mitzvahs, right? All those things. And then tefillah helps. So the Rambam actually believes the same kind of thing. It's the same principle that it works on. That is, tefillah has a different way of accomplishing things. That is, tefillah, it doesn't do the things that people think, but it focuses one of the things that Phil does is it focuses your mind on the essential issues that one is supposed to focus on. And then that's what brings me hashgacha. Yes. So instead of saying it's the mitzvahs that bring me hashgacha, I do mitzvahs, because we all believe, we don't think that, none of us, I think, believe that I say it, I can kill and steal and rape, and then the tefillah helps me. I don't think anybody believes that. It's the same, he just switches the emphasis. That is, if I use tefillah in the sense of its appropriate sense, and I use it as a vehicle to focus on the essential truths about God, then I do come under the umbrella of hashgacha.
We're just going to give. Hang on. Whoa. No. Oh no, they answered your question.
Does prayer help in one way or another? Is there hashgacha that it? Yes or no? You know, I don't.
I said no. Yeah. No, they said no. No, actually, for me, it's a very gratifying moment to know that other people are going to get into as big a trouble as Jay and I always get into.
I just said a few things. First of all, since you mentioned Refa'enu, and the next bracha after that is Barech Aleinu, today is December 5th, so you can add prayer for rain in the same equation. I don't know whether you're saying Refa'enu helped the people you were saying it for, but I assume it made you feel better. And because we have a need, there's a human need to do something. I mean, there's a famous story about World War I, I believe, some Jewish community was about to come under attack, and people were sitting around and didn't know what to do, and someone said, what are you just sitting here? Do something. Zach Tillem. So say Tillem to ward off the enemy. So whether or not it helps, what you want to know is, if I put, I don't know how much anymore, a dollar into a machine, I get a Coke out, then I see that there's a relationship between the activity I did and the result. But if I say the correct words, if I say Tal Matali Bracha, will it start raining? We don't always see the relationship. And the Rambam would say that there are meteorological considerations to take into account, which are significant in themselves and not related to how many people say the prayer for rain and with what kavanah. So the Rambam is saying that these things should be said. It's good for the community. It's good for the individual. It's good discipline for the individual. It might help the individual feel better, but don't think that it is some sort of magic where if you say the right words, you get the right results.
Thank you very much to everybody. I know it could be, there are lots and lots of questions. That's really the idea. The idea is not to have the answers. The questions, as we know, are always more important. I want to thank our speakers, all of our speakers, for really a wonderful day of inspiration and thought. And there's a lot we don't know on the Rambam. And I want to thank all of you. I think I'm quite amazed how many people stayed throughout the whole day. And I think we can make a mincha minyan in 5-6 minutes upstairs in the base mattress. Okay, not mincha minyan for what? Oh boy. The halach and the shulchan aruch and in the Rambam. The Rambam says that tefillah is midoraita after davin. We hope to see you on December 26th, Tuesday night. Have a good day. Don't forget to tain talamatar. Yeah, if you want CDs, you can sign up for CDs. Thanks to Elliot, Dr. Lasker, Dr. Zieskin, Dr. Green, Dr. Diamond. Have a good day.